You're listening to The Hub on Screen, and now it's time to look at a film releasing locally in cinemas. It's a documentary about one of our greatest sporting heroes.
When he was about 10 or 12, him and his mate found the old motorbike with no back wheel in it, in some of the warehouses in the industrial area. And
so I said, let's go and ask the guy, can we have it? I said, well, you want to give it to us? And he goes, no, I'll sell it to you for $5.
Sheldon put an ad in the paper for a back wheel.
That was the start of my career, gone halves in a $5 motorcycle.
A new Australian documentary about one of our greatest sporting champions is releasing this week. It's a rags-to-riches story about a boy from Wollongong who conquered the world. But it's also a film about childhood sweethearts, and in a way it's also a film about a country coming of age. Wayne is the one-word title of the documentary. Now, for many, it will be enough to instantly bring to mind its subject, Wayne Gardner, the iconic motorcycle racing champion. Gardner appears in the film along with his friends, family, and rivals. He in particular looks relaxed and affable, every so often breaking out into a cheeky giggle that still now, all those millions of dollars later and many grey hairs later as well, makes him seem like a working class kid larrikin, basically. Joining me now is the director of Wayne, Jeremy Sims. Jeremy, welcome to The Hub on Screen.
Thanks, Jason. Good to be here.
Now, were you a fan of Wayne Gardner growing up in the 70s? Did you know about him? Did you follow his career?
I'm one of those people of a certain age, and those people out there will know who they are, that I was 21 in 1987 when he won the World Motorcycle Championship. And SBS showed every race live. It's kind of the first time, apart from the Ashes and Wimbledon, that we had live TV, and certainly on SBS. And it was just one of those things. We all sat up 3 in the morning that year and we watched him win the world championship. I had no interest in motorcycle racing before that. I'd never heard of him really, and I never really knew much about him afterwards. But that year when I was 21 at university, I vividly remember all those nights with friends sitting up to watch him race in Austria or Czechoslovakia or all these places that we wanted to go to. So that was my connection to the story. The rest of it I didn't really know much about.
And when you met him, were you surprised at how charismatic he was? He's such a great subject.
Yeah, he's a complicated guy, which is why he's a good guy to make a documentary about. He can be absolutely charming when he needs to be, and if he doesn't want to do something, he can be incredibly stubborn and difficult.
Did that happen with you? With the things?
Not
he
with me
to
so much, yeah. But I watched him do it with other people, where he just went, "Nope, not doing that." And yeah, he's a really interesting guy. I mean, he raced at the top level for 10 years. He is a legend now as well. So you've got to remember when you meet those guys, and I hung around with him a lot in Europe. I went to a lot of racetracks and stuff, and he's Wayne Gardner still. So he gets up in the morning, he's Wayne Gardner. And
he's a superstar in his world.
He's a superstar in his sport. I mean, he's still very approachable and he's funny and he's lovely, but he's got some mongrel in him and it's still there.
Well, it struck me that you'd struck gold with not only him, but his friends and family. Everyone is so articulate, and there's a kind of Anglo-Saxon blue-collar sensibility in many of them, his parents, some of his friends. Their turns of phrases are great, including Wayne's. You know, like what does he say at one point? I was like a cat in a fish shop.
And I was like a rat with a gold tooth and all those things. They really are a proper working-class Wollongong family. And as he said, his dad carted coal in a big truck. That's what he did for all of his working life. Nowadays, we can't even kind of comprehend that, you know. I love the bit where he says, when I was a kid at school, I didn't know that we were sort of working class because my dad drove a big truck. And as far as I was concerned, it was better than being a doctor or a train driver or a lawyer or anything, because he drove a big truck. But yeah, they're really working class. They've got beautiful turn of phrase, and he's never lost it. There's zero kind of tickets on Wayne still. He's very arrogant in the way that he knows what he's good at and what he believes in, but he doesn't put on airs at all.
Yeah.
And he's never kind of stepped up into the world the way more that Donna has. Donna can move in those circles more easily than he can.
Well, Donna's really interesting. She appears as definitely the most well-groomed of all the interviewees. And I didn't know much about her or what ends up happening to her in this story, which you reveal, you know, at the very end of the film. All I see is this very attractive blonde woman with hair slicked back, wearing a kind of dark blue what looks like a power suit.
Classic
Very
80s.
Very stylish.
Classics.
But stylish, you know, like with shoulder pads. Yeah. And she looks like someone who would have walked on to set on her front foot saying to you, I'm going to tell my version of this story and I'm ready to.
Yeah, it's funny. She's not that. She's not pushy. Like, she was gold. The moment she started talking and we started doing the interview, I did a pre-interview with her in Monaco where she was living at the time, and I went, oh, my God, okay, we've got a movie. Because at that point, there's the whole story of his career, which is, you know, fascinating. But from my point of view, I needed the B story to be interesting. And the moment I started talking with her, I went, okay, this is going to be great. I mean, she's only been with two people in her life, and both of them are millionaires. And in between, she's been in Wollongong. And there's kind of a reason for it. She's got a strange kind of fantastic charm about her. And she's very honest and very effusive. For her, clearly, this was the greatest time of her life. And she wants to talk about it. So we all got very lucky with Donna being so fantastic.
I think what's attractive about her as well in terms of her personality is that there's a real lack of sort of bitterness or regret, oddly. Or perhaps not oddly, but she's had a great life, it seems. But she's very charismatic for that, I think.
Yeah, it's a chicken and egg thing. I think she's had a great life because of that as well. She really is. She's a glass half full person. Just walks through life working out, well, how can I make something good out of this? And she was perfect for Wayne. The two of them are incredible.
Childhood
as a
sweethearts. They'd been
Childhood
together. She met him when she was what?
Well, you know, that's one of the funny things about it. She was about 14 when they met. I reckon he was 17. She was still 17 when she got on a jumbo jet and flew to England on her own to be with her motorcycle racing boyfriend and live with him. And her parents let her go. So it's a different time.
It is a different time. I think her dad was, what was the another great turn of phrase she talks about?
He fluffed up like a chicken.
Fluffed up like a chicken. He was very nervous about it, but the mum said, let her go. Tell me about how this story of Wayne Gardner, and especially his initial ascent, winning the 500cc World Championship in 87, then in 89, winning the Phillip Island Motorcycle Grand Prix in Australia, the first Motorcycle Grand Prix in Australia. In the middle of that, those 2 years, you've got the Australian Bicentennial.
Yep.
And some of that archival footage that you show is gold, you know. Tell me about
We had a lot more too. I can tell you that whenever I watch it now, I want to show people the 3.5 hour version because there's a lot more to it.
Well, I remember at the time, I think there was a 24-hour telecast that was across the country.
There was, and it was hosted by every cheesy Australian celebrity you've ever met. And, we watched it in its entirety again, and it's cringingly awful. I mean, just it's really mind-numbingly bad.
Well, I don't know. I remember they went to, at one point, they crossed to an Italian wedding where the Italian girl is getting married to, I can't remember, an Indian man.
I think it's a Greek guy or something. There's some plate smashing. The whole thing is, there's absolute gold through it. But this other stuff, you know, Paul Hogan is so resolutely Australian male and won't, and that kind of thing of we don't blow our own trumpet in this country. So how do you have a 24-hour celebration of a nation without saying we're great?
Celebration of a nation.
Yeah, yeah.
But tell me how Wayne Gardner's career sort of alternates with the story of the nation.
Yeah, the two had this weird confluence, which was kind of why he's remembered so much, I think. There's no doubt that in the late 80s, Australia, on the back of floating the dollar and Paul Keating's internationalism and celebrities like Greg Norman and INXS and Midnight Oil and getting involved in the global political debate and getting out from under the kind of the colonial, you know, we've got a lovely clip of Paul Keating deriding the Liberals for doffing their cap to the old colonial forebears. And that late 80s period is unique. And it really was a growing up period for Australia. And in a weird way, because he's from Wollongong and because he was working class and he didn't put on any airs, him being a big celebrity and just being who he was perfect for the time. And he was literally the most famous person in Australia for about 12 months. It was, it was incredible looking at all the footage of it now.
But what I'm reminded of as well in this part of the documentary that depicts the height of his, or that first big flush of fame for him coinciding with the Bicentennial is that it seems like a much simpler time, a kind of time of innocence. Now, I know in Australia we've had moratorium marches, we've had feminist marches and green bands and all sorts of radical sort of forces and tensions and protests and so forth. But that late 80s period and the way that it was, the way that the Bicentennial was packaged, and the way Wayne Gardner fitted into all of that seems incredibly uncomplicated now.
Yeah, it does. There's a naivety to it, which is attractive, I think, and particularly if you're old enough to remember it. I mean, I show it to my kids have watched it, and they kind of just don't get it, really, because in their heads they watch the news. We're part of the globe. You know, they don't really understand that in the 70s we were really cut off from the rest of the world in a really fundamental way, and that those bridges only kind of got built in the 80s.
Well, and I was going to say, what I neglected to say just then as well is, of course, we've since become so much more aware of Indigenous issues. And I know they were bubbling away all through the 70s and into the 80s. But there's something that also sort of the absence of a kind of complexity is something that's quite interesting to me. I mean, I'm not saying that there's a strand that's absent from your film or anything, but seeing Wayne Gardner do that victory lap at Phillip Island with the Australian flag, and I was just thinking, wow, I don't think we can again have an iconic kind of very uncomplicated patriotic image like that again in this country.
No, I don't think so. We're in the post-truth world now where everything's nuanced and relativist. It was a simple time, but weirdly enough, it was the beginning of the complicated time.
It was, absolutely.
He was the last kind of warrior of that simple way of looking at the world. Couple that with the fact that the racing itself was, in those days, incredibly dangerous. And that's something we've lost in all sport now as well. We're very aware.
What's changed with that? Yeah, I noticed.
Well, we don't like people to be badly injured or hurt anymore. We put great value, great stock on human lives. And that whole kind of liberal worldview has made it impossible to say, oh, in our sport, look, occasionally people die, so what? You can't say that anymore now. You go, well, then you can't play your sport. Whereas certainly in the 70s, in 500cc motorcycle racing, on the world circuit, someone died every year, sometimes two or three, and globally, like dozens of people died.
What changed with the bikes?
The bikes were particularly, they're two-stroke bikes, which none of them are anymore. You're not allowed to ride two-stroke bikes anymore because they mix the fuel with the oil, and so the exhaust has all the fuel in it as well. And because the manufacturers don't sell two-stroke bikes, in the late 90s, early noughties, they changed the Formula One to four-stroke. And all that means really is that two-stroke bikes respond incredibly quickly. So a 500cc two-stroke bike is the equivalent of a 1000cc big bike. And it's got more power, and it has a power band that's much, much narrower. So, which is why you have all those famous high sides where the riders
some wonderful,
get kicked
over. Yeah. I mean, when I say wonderful, some horrifying images
it to a kind of a 70s glam track. And they were incredibly racing days. And when I spoke to the riders and the fans in the making of the movie, all of them get misty-eyed about the late 70s and 80s. One of the characters says, Nick Harris, who's like the god of motorcycle racing, says there were maybe half a dozen people that could ride those bikes properly out of all of the people on the planet.
Yep. And even they ended up being flung over the handlebars every so often when they weren't handling the clutch properly. I'm speaking about the new Australian documentary, Wayne, about Wayne Gardner. My guest is the director of Wayne, Jeremy Sims. There are moments in every sort of historical documentary when you just don't have the footage and you have to go into historical recreations. You've opted for cartoons, and it's a wonderful kind of cartoon style that you've also chosen. Tell me about that.
Some decisions are really easy, and that was a really early one where I went manga cartoons, like I used to watch on TV in the morning. I used to watch Speed Racer and those Japanese manga things. A couple of reasons. One is that in manga, the hero is nearly always a man boy character, which was Wayne in England. And because a lot of them are about determination, you know, that shot where they grit their teeth and their eyes narrow is a classic manga sort of trope. So for a bunch of reasons, and because we were doing motorcycle racing, and there is a fantastic manga cartoon from the 80s called Motorcycle Racer, which is Japanese. So for all those reasons, we went down that path. And then there was a lovely subtlety, and that was the editor, Tim Woodhouse's decision to use my hand-drawn bits to begin with, and to slowly morph them into the sophisticated manga that we finish, you know, in the doco
so,
with.
So these are your hand-drawn sketches that then morph into...
Yeah, I mean, my hand-drawn sketches were actually even worse than the hand-drawn ones that are in the doco. In the end, the artist did them, but we used them in the cut for a long time. But yeah, it was just a nice idea. We were scheduled to do recreation shots and shooting, and don't forget, I've never made a documentary before in my life, so this was a whole learning curve for me right from the beginning. But yeah, it was understood that we would do that. And after a certain point, I said, look, I don't think I want to. I can't see it looking good. I can't see it telling the story. And why don't we do cartoons? And thankfully, the producers were really on board with that, so we went down that path.
Do you walk away from making a film like this with your ideas about success, what makes a winner, what makes a champion, changed in any way? Did you have any insights into that special X factor?
Yeah. Particularly because Wayne has a son, Remy, who races, and I really hope that Remy's going to make it, but he has been given, he races Moto2. He's a brilliant kid, and he may make it, but he has come at it from having a wealthy dad who's given him every opportunity in the world to get there. Wayne got on a motorbike, and the moment he got on it, as he describes in the doco, and went, oh my God, that's who I am. I race motorbikes. And I think, you know, the light for me in this is that to be really, really exceptional at one thing, you need to have that moment of connection, whether it's with your instrument or your motorbike or being on stage or whatever. You have to have that epiphany. You have to have that kind of Paulian, that Saulian transformation on the road to Damascus that says, this is who I am, not just what I do, but who I am. And he's a classic example of it. You know, Wayne couldn't have done anything else other than that.
Jeremy Sims, it's been a pleasure.
Cheers, mate.
That's Jeremy Sims, director of the new documentary Wayne, about Wayne Gardner, which is out in cinemas this week.